There is no injunction, formal or informal, against anybody taping this and handing it to anybody else they want to. We encourage it. We feel that the work that we do will stand up to any inspection, and we are more than happy. In fact, that's why we're doing this in the first place, is so the largest amount of people can have access to some things that are rather hard to get access to, and most of those things are books, and not that the books themselves are always obscure, although some of them are, but mostly just because most people don't have much opportunity to do much reading about political things, and if they're interested in something, they might not want to wade through 300 or 400 or 800-page books to find out about it. And we realize that's a perhaps lamentable fact in this day and age, but nonetheless, it's there. And we're going to do our best to put some things together and to excerpt certain things and put them together into the most, and again, you'll have to remember this as we're going through this, we're putting this together in the most palatable and understandable sort of form that we can. So we are doing the hard work for you. We, Dave to a large extent, but myself also, have gone through most of this stuff at one time or another extensively and exhaustively, and we have culled out a lot of the stuff, the superfluous, and we're getting to the meat of the subject, and we're handing it on to you. So then it is your responsibility, if you are willing to take it on, to do your best to do something with it, whatever might seem appropriate to you.
All righty. Now, we're going to be talking about terrorism, and one of the things we're going to be focusing on primarily is Middle Eastern terrorism. Not exclusively, but terrorism in and around the Middle East is going to be one of the main focuses of the broadcast this evening. And in order to get a handle on Middle East terrorism and the development of it, we're going to be taking a look at the development of not only the Egyptian Security Service, but also the Libyan Secret Service as well. And we're going to see how the political development of those countries' secret services relates directly to the whole terrorist question.
Indeed. And the first thing we're going to be reading for tonight, we're going to be discussing the formation of several European, several Middle Eastern security services, and at the same time, the parallel formation of certain Middle East terror groups. And interestingly enough, these things are not so dissimilar, and they do in fact have some common roots going right back to the Second World War, as many of our longtime listeners will not be surprised to find out. Now, the first book we're going to be reading from is a book entitled Galen, Spy of the Century. Galen, of course, G-E-H-L-E-N. Galen, Spy of the Century. The book was written by E.H. Cookridge, copyright 1971, from Random House in New York. Now, again, for those who are just getting into this stuff for the first time and are not familiar with the name, since Galen himself is not going to be the primary focus of this particular segment, let me just explain to you very quickly. Reinhard Galen was the head of Hitler's Eastern Secret Service, the Fremde Heere Ost, the Foreign Armies East, and was, in fact, the leading intelligence expert on the Russian front and the Eastern front in general. At the end of World War II, realizing that he would probably be valuable to somebody, he promptly jumped to the American side, actually before the war was even over, brought his files, turned himself over, put himself in the hands of Alan Dulles, who was only too glad to have him. And Alan Dulles actually formed most of the Russian and Eastern European Bureau of the then just being born CIA around Reinhard Galen's operation. And in fact, Galen basically put his entire Nazi organization right back to work with the help of American military intelligence and the CIA. Took a lot of people right out of the docket at Nuremberg, put them back into working condition, except now they were working for the American CIA. Galen later went on to work for NATO intelligence and also fulfilling the same function, that is, as a Soviet and Eastern European expert beyond compare, and then later went on to take the core of his organization and form the German, West German Secret Service at the time that West Germany was permitted to have its own intelligence network. And that became the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst. The BND you might want to remember because that will come up during the course of the broadcast tonight and in the course of subsequent broadcasts. Anyway, so the basic fact being Galen was Hitler's master spy, and he became America's master spy in Eastern Europe, and then set up the West German Secret Intelligence Service. Never actually did a day's time for any of his activities as one of the most dangerous Nazis of all, and remained a diehard Nazi to the end of his days.
A Nazi in philosophy. He never actually joined the Nazi Party, but he worked hand in glove with it, and in fact, during the closing days of the Third Reich was working intimately with the RSHA, the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the High Bureau of Reich Security, of which the SS and Gestapo were the two primary components. Again, Galen, not actually a member of the Nazi Party, but his Nazi sympathies, and as Nip indicated, the numerous Nazi war criminals, SS and Gestapo veterans, Final Solution veterans that he put to work with his organization, are front and center and very relevant this evening, because one of the things we're going to be looking at is the role of the Galen Organization, its Nazi sympathies, and some of its active Nazi components in with regard to the development of certain aspects of Middle East terrorism, and terrorism even going up to the present day in other parts of the world. And so the Nazi sympathies of the Galen Organization are front and center in considering the historical development of terrorism as we're going to deal with it this evening.
Yeah, and elaborating on Dave's point even a little more, I believe even in this book, although it's been a long time since I've read it, but Galen has been quoted several times long after the end of World War II, well into the 50s, as still being very anti-Semitic. Galen was prone to making strongly anti-Semitic comments, he did indeed hold the reactionary views necessary to get along with people like Franz Alfred Sieks and Klaus Barbie and some of the other folk.
Well, this book itself actually is sort of doesn't do any great damage to Galen personally. In our third Radio Free America program, the one specifically about Galen and his organization, and that is available from DAVCOR that we'll tell you about late in the broadcast, we read a long section from an interview done with Galen by William Stevenson from the Borman Brotherhood,
right,
where he does, in fact, if you'd actually like to hear some of his verbatim remarks, you can hear not only some of his anti-Semitism, but his views about the tremendous betrayal of Germany by England during World War II, which is sort of a novel interpretation of history. And to get an idea of just what Galen is like as a person, that interview from Radio Free America number 3 will give you a pretty good idea. As if, as Stevenson himself says, the glimpse of the numerous mass murderers that he put to work in his organization wouldn't be quite sufficient.
All right. Now, again, so this short capsule working biography of Reinhard Galen, you will realize then as we are going, again, as Dave said, how much not only he himself, but the people that he hired and their particular views about world politics and racial politics, how important they are in the formation of Middle Eastern terrorism.
Now, one of the persons that is going to be front and center in the broadcast this evening with regard to terrorism in the Middle East and elsewhere is a name that's going to be introduced in the section Nip's about to read you. The man's name is Otto Skorzeny, last name Skorzeny. He's going to be one of the common threads running throughout the broadcast. So listen for his name, and we'll tell you more about him later.
All right. Reading from Galen, Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge. When the British government decided to contract out of Egypt, the United States, having taken on the thankless task of the world's policemen, moved in. In 1951, Alan Dulles had sent one of his leading Middle East experts to Cairo. Just to mention real quickly, for those not familiar, Alan Dulles, brother of John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower, Alan Dulles eventually became head of the CIA. In 1951, Alan Dulles had sent one of his leading Middle East experts to Cairo, Kermit Kim Roosevelt, a grandson of President Teddy Roosevelt, the Rough Rider. Kim Roosevelt had already accomplished difficult assignments in Syria and Iran. From Cairo, he reported that King Farouk's situation was hopeless, and, with Dulles' approval, he opened secret negotiations with the Free Officers Committee, led by a charming young colonel named Gamal Abdul Nasser, with whom he had, quote, found a large area of agreement, unquote. After Black Saturday in January 1952, when rioters went on the rampage in Cairo and Farouk was forced to abdicate, Nasser and Roosevelt agreed that the revolution should be carried out by easy stages. Farouk's infant son was proclaimed king, only to be replaced by the Republic under the figurehead General Naguib. Within a year, Colonel Nasser was in power. Washington regarded him as a valuable ally who would keep communism and the Russians out of the Middle East. At first, everything seemed to go according to CIA's plans. Nasser's first measure was to suppress the Communist Party in Egypt and to imprison all its leaders. The grateful American government poured $40 million a year into Egypt's economy, which had been ruined by Farouk's extravagance and his minister's corruption. Alan Dulles sent Nasser a personal gift from President Eisenhower's unvouchered funds of $3 million, which Kim Roosevelt's colleague Miles Copeland conveyed to Nasser's secretary in two suitcases. Next, Nasser asked Roosevelt to help him reorganize Egypt's military intelligence and secret service in order to buttress his personal power. Political considerations meant that official employment of U.S. officers and CIA agents by the Egyptian government was out of the question, however. Thus, it came about that Dulles approached Galen for assistance. Before continuing, I should just mention that the State of Israel had been formerly chartered only a few years earlier. Of course, they were already in a great deal of struggle and conflict with the other Middle Eastern powers, of which Egypt was, if not the leader, was certainly close to it. This is the political considerations that they're referring to because, of course, already the United States was one of the leading supporters of Israel, if not the leading supporter. At that time, Galen was absorbed in his struggle with Volvever, who had taken charge of the East German Ministry for State Security after the Berlin Uprising. Nevertheless, he obliged his friend Dulles by recruiting a, quote, military mission of former officers of Hitler's army in the SS. This mission was dispatched to Egypt under ex-Waffen-SS General Wilhelm Farnbacher. In time, it grew to 200 officers. Besides the military mission, however, Nasser needed men to organize his secret service, directing espionage and training saboteurs against Israel, and also to advise on the surveillance of his many enemies inside Egypt, such as the powerful Muslim Brotherhood. Again, his American advisors turned to Galen, asking him to recommend someone qualified to take on the task. During the secret negotiations which followed, Galen thought at one stage of sending one of his own experts from Pulak. He had several men who had conducted espionage against the British during the war in Libya, Egypt, and Iran, but he could not realistically spare one of sufficiently high rank to impress Nasser. He therefore suggested his old colleague, ex-SS Sturmbannführer Otto Skorzeny, of Zeppelin fame, to take on the assignment in Egypt. After the war, Skorzeny had spent 3 years in American captivity in Germany as a suspected war criminal. He had been released in July 1948 and was living in Spain, where he had established a prosperous engineering business. I should stop to insert into Mr. Cookridge's manuscript that one of the things that he had established in Spain was the beginnings of the German SS post-war organization known as Die Spinne, the Spider, which he was operating from Spain at that time with the help of Franco's intelligence services and military intelligence, etc. He was not merely a prosperous engineer. Anyway, going along with E.H. Cookridge, he was promised, meaning Skorzeny, he was reluctant to accept, meaning to accept Galen's commission. For one thing, the Egyptians offered little financial inducement. He was promised that CIA would top up his salary from Nasser. Dulles and Galen also approached Skorzeny's father-in-law, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, once Hitler's financial wizard, who, after his acquittal at Nuremberg and the quashing of his 8 years sentence under the denazification laws, had become president of a bank in Dusseldorf. So, besieged from so many sides, Herr Skorzeny graciously agreed on the condition that his stay in Cairo should be limited. Skorzeny worked in Egypt for about a year, and then left Nasser's secret service in the good hands of other SS and Gestapo men. He had recruited about 50, of whom some had to be summoned from Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Spain, where they had found a safe haven from Allied prosecution as war criminals. Amongst his assistants was a high official of Goebbels' propaganda ministry and Himmler's RSHA, Franz Bünsch, spelled B-U-E-N-S-C-H, an, quote, expert on Jewish matters. He had worked with Eichmann on the Final Solution during the war and had written a book entitled Sexual Habits of the Jews, which was probably the most viciously pornographic document ever produced by the Nazis. These German intelligencers in Cairo looked to Galen for advice, and he appointed a liaison officer to them, whom he sent from Germany. He was a bird of the same feather as they, an ex-SS officer and deputy Reich leader of the Hitler Youth, Hermann Lauterbacher. The German-led Egyptians... Hermann Lauterbacher. Skipping on down.
Oh, one thing I recall at the beginning of the program as Nip was explaining the Galen organization. During the stage of the Galen organization that was described in the passage Nip just read, it was part of the CIA. Now, the part that he's about to read now is after the Galen organization has become the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German CIA. But as you'll see, it appears to have been business as usual with regard to Galen policy in the Middle East, whether as CIA or BND.
To the Cairo residency of BND, Galen sent one of his senior officers, 35-year-old Gerhard Bauch, B-A-U-C-H, the stepson of Galen's vice president, Major General Hans Heinrich Vorgitsky. Bauch lived in Cairo under the cover of a representative of the Quant Corporation, the German heavy industry concern. At Damascus, the BND resident was ex-SS Hauptsturmführer Alois Brunner, alias Jörg Fischer, who posed as a director of the German-Syrian trading company Otraco. Brunner later joined Bunch in Cairo. They were old colleagues, for they had both worked under Eichmann at the RSHA, quote, Jewish department. Okay, so now the main thing that we want to look at here, and that Cookridge, again, a man, well, I don't think we mentioned it yet tonight, Cookridge is a man who has quite a bit of admiration for General Galen, and because, of course, General Galen went to work for the United States and for the Western Allies and et cetera. But even Cookridge, of course, has difficulty overlooking the fact that the people that were sent at the request of the United States, and again, remember that Israel at this time was struggling for existence in the Middle East, was already essentially at war with most of the Middle East, and most notably Egypt, that at the bequest, the request and the behest of Alan Dulles, Reinhard Galen, again himself, one of the most intelligent men and one of the most important men in the German German high command as far as the persecution of war matters, Reinhard Galen was sending people to work for and to, in fact, set up the Egyptian security service in one of the world's most touchy areas, who were, in fact, people who had been working on the final solution, and not only working on the final solution, but were fairly high up in such organizations as the RSHA. Now, again, we have to look at this and put this in perspective. This is, well, the first part what they were talking about when Skorzeny was initially contacted, this is 7 years after the war in Europe was over. In other words, the buildings had barely stopped smoking, and the graves were still covered with fresh soil, practically, to wax metaphorical, when the Americans, again, Alan Dulles, was sending final solution veterans, people like
Franz Bunch, and in fact, we're going to show you some real final solution veterans. We're going to show you some of the real heavy hitters, which, now remember, the Galen, the Cookridge book, rather, was published in 1971. We're going to look at a book published 10 years later, which is going to have some even more damning information about the same group, which I'll save here for just a second. The point being, this is done, as Nip said, 7 years after the conclusion of World War II, as the buildings were still smoking, practically, as he indicated. And in fact, in Eastern Europe, the fighting was just winding down, the guerrilla warfare we discussed in our first Radio Free America show. It's worth noting that this the formation of the Egyptian Secret Service and Military Intelligence was not only accomplished under CIA auspices, but specifically an obvious Third Reich bent was given to these organizations by the diehard Nazis who were and anti-Semites who were placed in key positions to reconstruct the Egyptian services.
Indeed. And basically, I think that pretty much sums up the point I was going to make, which is that at the very least, and this is granting Alan Dulles and his CIA brethren a great degree of leeway, at the very least, you would have to say it was an extremely politically dangerous move to make. However, when we put this into the context, and as people who have listened to the other Radio Free Americas and are familiar with some of the things that the CIA was, and the group that was going to become the CIA and military intelligence for America, some of the things these people were doing at the end of World War II, we realize that, in fact, there was nothing unconscious or accidental about this, that it was a systematic attempt to take the people who were considered to be the most ruthless and dangerous anti-communists in the world, the Nazis, and turn them right around again and sick them on our late allies, the Soviet Union, and the Middle East was only one further opportunity to do it. Now, where Israel came into these discussions and into these considerations, because obviously Israel was considered to be a potentially valuable ally in the Middle East, and to think about Alan Dulles gleefully paying Otto Skorzeny's extra salary so he would take the job on so he could bring people like Bunch and these others over into the Middle East, it boggles the mind. But even so, at this point, very early on, within a few years after the war is over, the United States has already made what I think virtually any a civil libertarian or progressive thinker would have to think a crippling decision as far as national morality, and unfortunately, as we shall see, a crippling decision as far as Middle Eastern stability goes.
Right. Now, the this CIA-sponsored Galen and Skorzeny mission to the Middle East is worth noting for our purposes because the roots of Middle Eastern terrorism are to be found in this Nazi contingent that Galen dispatched under CIA auspices to Egypt and, as we're going to see in a minute, Libya as well. Now, one of the most infamous, the most infamous name probably of all the people involved with the final solution is going to crop up here as one of the officers who Skorzeny commanded in Egypt, and we're also going to take a look at the development of the very first Palestinian terrorist groups under Skorzeny's auspices while in the Middle East. It should be mentioned at this point that Otto Skorzeny was not only one of Hitler's personal favorites, but was in charge of commando training for the Third Reich. He was perhaps, you can't say he was most famous Third Reich military veteran, but one of the most famous Third Reich military veterans. Among his exploits, he rescued Mussolini after Mussolini had been imprisoned following the overthrow of his government. He also effected he was very active against partisans in places like Denmark. We're going to take a look at a key Skorzeny kidnapping, the kidnapping of Miki Horthy, the son of the head of the Hungarian government, which prevented a switching of sides of Hungary. Hungary had fought on the side of the Axis. Horthy, however, seeing the writing on the wall for the Axis powers, was preparing a negotiation with the Allies and the Soviet Union in particular, whereby he was going to switch sides. As we're going to take a look at Skorzeny and his career, a kidnapping of Admiral Horthy's son was able to basically postpone that switching of sides until the actual defeat of the Hungarian armed forces. Now, we're going to be reading, again, bear in mind the mission that Nip just told you about, reading from the Cookridge book, the CIA-sponsored Galen and Skorzeny mission to the Middle East. We're going to take a look at a closer look at that very same mission. This is from a book published 10 years after the Cookridge book. We're going to be reading now from a book called Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando. That was authored by Glenn Infield, published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1981. And of Skorzeny and the mission to Egypt, Infield writes, his first task was to organize a staff of former SS and Wehrmacht officers to train the Egyptian army and security forces. He selected carefully, making certain that each officer he brought to Egypt was a diehard Nazi, an expert military tactician, and was anti-Semitic. Among those recruited by Skorzeny were SS General Oskar Dürrewanger, Dirlewanger, who had commanded a brigade composed of poachers, criminals, and men under the sentence of court-martial during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and whose actions against the Jews had earned him the nickname Butcher of Warsaw. SS Colonel Adolf Eichmann, the officer Himmler charged with the destruction of millions of Jews, and who later would be kidnapped from Argentina by the Israeli Secret Service and smuggled back to Israel to stand trial. I'm going to read that last sentence again because this is worth noting. Now remember, in this instance, Eichmann is operating actually as a contract agent for the CIA. Although not a regular agent, he is operating here technically under contract to the CIA. Once again, this is one of the most intriguing details I've ever seen about the Galen organization. This is, once again, folks, a CIA mission here. Reading from Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando. Among the people Skorzeny recruited, SS Colonel Adolf Eichmann, the officer Himmler charged with the destruction of millions of Jews, and who later would be kidnapped from Argentina by the Israeli Secret Service and smuggled back to Israel to stand trial. SS General Wilhelm Farnbacher, Panzer General Oskar Munzel, Leopold Gleim, former chief of Hitler's personal guard, and Gestapo security chief of German-occupied Poland, and Joachim Daimling, former chief of the Gestapo in Dusseldorf. To handle medical problems, Skorzeny recruited Dr. Heinz Eisele, E-I-S-E-L-E, who had been chief medical officer at Buchenwald concentration camp, and Heinrich Willemann, former medical director at Dachau. A really intriguing collection of people for Otto Skorzeny and the CIA to have in Egypt training the Egyptian Secret Service. And in light of some of the things that cropped out of this particular association, it's not too surprising that a pattern of bloodshed was being established at this point. Now, still later in the Skorzeny book by Infield, Infield goes into one of the most important details for our purposes of the broadcast this evening, namely the fact that while serving as a CIA contract agent in Egypt on this very mission that we've just been describing, Otto Skorzeny set up the first Palestinian terrorist groups. Reading again from Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando. Skorzeny was already training an Arab Foreign Legion in commando tactics. This unit was comprised of 400 former Nazis and Gestapo veterans and used a training base at Bilbias in the Delta. He also helped organize and train the first Palestine terrorists and planned their initial forays into Israel by way of the Gaza Strip about 1953 and 4. Voss, that's Wilhelm Voss, a key West German representative in Egypt. Voss was aware, too, that Skorzeny had no intention of leaving Egypt except for his periodic trips to Argentina and other countries where Odessa had business and political interests and to his home base in Madrid. So while on this CIA-sponsored mission, employing the likes of Adolf Eichmann, Franz Bunch, and so forth, Otto Skorzeny sets up and helps organize and or helps plan the forays for the first Palestinian terrorist groups. This is significant for our purposes because Palestinian terrorism is one of the things we're going to be looking at great length this evening.
And of course, one of the local and late bywords for terror has become, of course, Libya. Muammar Gaddafi. Just today, on my way up to the station, I was listening to a news broadcast about the Texas Border Patrol and how they're all on basically permanent alert these days, waiting for the Libyan terrorists to come flooding up into the United States from Mexico. They haven't had any come through yet, but they're ready for them. While we're hearing the word Libya and the word terrorism constantly linked now on our national media, virtually inextricable at this point, and I mean that seriously. I challenge any of you out there to think of the last news story that you heard about Libya that had nothing to do with terrorism. I challenge you. Anyway, while we're thinking about that, let's examine a little bit about the antecedents there, too, and just see if by any strange coincidence this could fit into some of the rest of the pattern that's beginning to form here. We're going to read a short segment from a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. The book is by Paul Manning, and it's copyright 1981 by Lyle Stewart Incorporated. Mr. Manning writes, when Colonel Nasser became president of Egypt, he asked the CIA for assistance in establishing a similar organization in his country. The CIA did not wish to become involved and so referred him to General Galen, then chief of the West German Federal Intelligence Organization, which was in fact maintained by the CIA. And this is an important point, again, as Dave made earlier. This sentence is a little circuitous, but the point, I think, is clear when re-examined. Let's read it again. The CIA did not wish to become involved and so referred him to General Galen, then chief of the West German Federal Intelligence Organization, which was in fact maintained by the CIA. In other words, this is before the BND was a nominally separate entity, and as Dave pointed out, these folks are then, in effect, CIA contract agents.
By the way, the Mueller referred to, this is a slightly different, this account differs in some details from the accounts given by Glenn Infield and also by Cookridge. In this particular accounting of the Skorzeny mission to Egypt for CIA, Heinrich Mueller's name comes up. Now, Heinrich Mueller was the head of the Gestapo. Probably the reason why Skorzeny and why Infield and Cookridge stayed away from it is officially Heinrich Mueller is supposed to be dead. In reality, when they finally unearthed his grave, they dug up his grave. There were three skeletons in it, none of whom was Heinrich Mueller. So, as Paul Manning, the author of this book, who did extensive firsthand investigation of the Nazi underground in Latin America, Heinrich Mueller not only survived the war, but in essence is the sort of security minister in exile for Third Reich elements. Basically, the Gestapo remained intact and has served as the enforcement wing of the post-war Nazi underground. Heinrich Mueller was not only alive and well, but was very active at the time of the writing of this book in 1981 at the ripe old age of 79. According to the account by Paul Manning here, it was Heinrich Mueller who basically provided Skorzeny with the staff that he used in Egypt.
Okay, continuing. The CIA did not wish to become involved and so referred him to General Galen. But Galen ducked the request, suggesting that former SS General Otto Skorzeny, son-in-law of Hjalmar Schacht, one-time Minister of Finance for Hitler, should be approached. Skorzeny, who made his headquarters in Spain, did not want the assignment either, for he was doing too well as an engineer and businessman in Spain and was also owner of a large farming establishment outside of Dublin. That's interesting. We'll get back to that later on. But, urged by Schacht, he had Heinrich Mueller in Brazil. Again, the gentleman Dave was just referring to, the man who managed to bury three people in his grave and not be dead himself. Urged by Schacht, Skorzeny had Heinrich Mueller in Brazil send him a team of secret police specialists who all arrived in Cairo as a German mission led by Skorzeny, who promptly returned to Spain after introductions had been made. Mueller's team established such an effective intelligence service for Nasser, known as the General Intelligence Service, that Colonel Gaddafi of Libya, then the new revolutionary leader of his country, asked Nasser to make the German team of advisors available to him also. This was done, and upon arrival, the Germans started with a thorough house cleaning of the Libyan secret police, hired by the previous ruler, King Idris. 2,000 Libyan police were put in jail and continue to languish there today, and the Germans rebuilt from scratch. Today, Libyan intelligence agents are stationed in all Libyan, African, and overseas embassies and consulates, and they are tough and ruthless. Perhaps as a quid pro quo to this service to Libya, the colonel granted the West German rocket company, ORTAG, rights to a vast test range 600 miles south of Tripoli in 1980. So again, Muammar Gaddafi, then the brand new revolutionary leader of Libya, also sent for Skorzeny's dial a Nazi security service and had them sent promptly over to Libya, where they formed the Libyan security service. And those same Libyan security agents who stationed in embassies have been wrecking some kind of havoc, including shooting a policewoman in Britain, which very nearly ended all relationships. Well, it did end all standard relationships between Britain and Libya a couple of years ago. But again, we are talking about a hand-picked group of anti-Semite diehard Nazis being contracted by the CIA through Reinhard Galen, sent to the Middle East to train the Egyptian security service, security and military intelligence, the folks who managed to let Anwar Sadat catch about 90 machine gun bullets, and the Libyan security service, the terrorists who are trained by them, of course, being the ones that we have our border patrol in Texas on 24-hour watch for.
Also, the ones that we had key CIA operatives Edwin Wilson and Frank Triple working with and arming a few years back. We're going to be coming back to the Triple Wilson connection
and
with
thereby,
regard to Libya.
Thereby hangs a tale indeed.
Indeed. And the point being here that the first Palestinian terrorist groups grow out of a Nazi mission to Egypt to reform the Egyptian military and intelligence services, and the that mission was accomplished under the auspices of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Galen Nazi wing under it and working for it at the time. Again, a key name to remember, the fellow who set up these first Palestinian terrorist groups while working as a contract agent for CIA, Otto Skorzeny, the commando chief of the Third Reich and a dominant person in shaping the pattern of post-war terrorism as well as setting up many of the organizations involved in it. So remember Skorzeny, remember the mission to Egypt that he carried out on behalf of Galen and CIA and the connections between that Nazi group and not only the Egyptian Secret Service but the Libyan Secret Service as well. Perhaps the most notorious of all terrorist incidents, certainly probably the best remembered, was the massacre of the Israeli athletes at the 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich, Germany. We're going to be taking a look at that particular incident in considerable length this evening, and we're going to begin looking at it right now. Specifically, we're going to take a look at the man who was credited with organizing the Olympics massacre, a Palestinian named Ali Hassan Salameh. That's Ali as A-L-I. Hassan, H-A-S-S-A-N, Salameh, S-A-L-A-M-E-H. Now, Ali Hassan Salameh is to be distinguished from Hassan Salameh. We're going to talk about Hassan Salameh, his father, in just a few minutes. But this is Ali Hassan Salameh, the leader of the Olympics massacre. An interesting article about Ali Hassan Salameh indicating that he also worked for the CIA appeared in the Wall Street Journal of February 10th, 1983. It's by David Ignatius, a Wall Street Journal reporter, and it's headlined, PLO operative slain reputedly by Israelis had been helping U.S. Subtitled, figure in Munich massacre died in a 1979 explosion. Role in diplomat safety. Arafat's American channel? Question mark. Dateline Washington. On January 22, 1979, an official of the Palestine Liberation Organization named Ali Hassan Salameh was killed in a car bomb explosion in Beirut. One of the most notorious PLO terrorists during the early 1970s, he had helped plan the seizure of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich. We have lost a lion, said PLO chairman Yasser Arafat. Mr. Salameh's corpse carried a hint that he was an unusual lion. In one of the dead man's pockets, according to a close friend, was a message sent that day from Bashir Jamal, the leader of the Lebanese Falangist militia and normally a ferocious enemy of the PLO, warning Mr. Salameh that his life was in danger. Shortly after the assassination, Admiral Stansfield Turner, then the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, briefed President Carter on the incident. The CIA's information about who had killed Mr. Salameh wasn't conclusive, but senior Carter administration officials say they suspected it was the Israelis. These officials say that despite Mr. Salameh's terrorist background, President Carter expressed concern, unquote, at his death. The reason for President Carter's dismay was that for over 5 years, Mr. Salameh, with Mr. Arafat's apparent approval, had been providing the CIA with intelligence that helped protect U.S. diplomats from extremist attacks by Palestinians and other Arabs. He had also helped implement an understanding with the U.S. Turning the page here. He had also helped implement an understanding with the U.S. reached in November of 1973 that Mr. Arafat's PLO mainstream group, Fatah, wouldn't harm Americans. Moreover, according to a top U.S. official, the U.S. had reason to believe that the Israelis knew, unquote, that Mr. Salameh was secretly helping the U.S. The Salome connection, which amounted to a backdoor channel between the U.S. and the PLO, is one of the most intriguing tales to emerge from the conspiracy-laden Middle East. It illustrates the complex intelligence operations undertaken by the U.S., the PLO, and the Israelis in this region. It also shows how, on occasion, U.S. and Israeli interests can differ sharply. Skipping down in the article. In mid-1973, Mr. Arafat and Mr. Salome began their opening to the U.S. for the PLO. The dialogue offered the prospect of eventual U.S. recognition of Palestinian rights. For the U.S., it offered a chance to curb terrorism against Americans, such as the March 1973 murder of two U.S. diplomats in Khartoum by a faction of Black September. The chronology of this secret U.S. PLO diplomacy is outlined by former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger in his recent volume of memoirs, Years of Upheaval, unquote. According to Mr. Kissinger, contacts began in late July of 1973 and climaxed in a secret meeting on November 3rd in Rabat, Morocco, between General Vernon Walters, then Deputy Director of the CIA, and a senior PLO official. The meeting produced what amounted to a non-aggression pact between the U.S. and Fatah. Mr. Kissinger writes that, quote, attacks on Americans, at least by Arafat's faction of the PLO, ceased, unquote. Mr. Salome, as chief of Fatah security, was responsible for enforcing this new policy. The first test came in December 16, 1973, when Mr. Kissinger visited Lebanon. Mr. Salome's friends say he advised the U.S. there might be an attempt in Beirut on Mr. Kissinger's life. Mr. Kissinger notes in his book, quote, a report that there was a plan to shoot down my plane, unquote. So the Kissinger plane was diverted to a Lebanese air base at Rayak in the Baca Valley east of Beirut. A Beirut source says that Mr. Salome marshaled a force of 6,000 people to protect Mr. Kissinger during this brief visit. And skipping down still further. Mr. Salome's help with security wasn't limited to the U.S. and his friends and his friend. Excuse me, starting again. Mr. Salome's help with security wasn't limited to the U.S., his friends in Beirut say. They say he tipped off the Saudis about various plots, including a plan by the PFLP to infiltrate saboteurs through South Yemen to blow up Saudi oil facilities. He provided assistance to security officials from West Germany, Italy, and Japan who were seeking information about links between their own domestic terrorists and Palestinian extremists. And in 1977, after Anwar Sadat's trip to Jerusalem, Mr. Salome helped pass information to Egypt about a Libyan-backed plot against Mr. Sadat. Skipping down still further, about the organization that Salome headed up. Only 37 years old when he died, he headed Mr. Arafat's Fatah Security and Intelligence Unit with up to 3,700 members and a monthly budget of $1.5 million. The unit was known as Squad 17, apparently because Mr. Salome's office was Extension 17 on the PLO military telephone network. Remember Squad 17. I'm going to read that last couple of sentences again because Squad 17 is going to figure prominently here. Only 37 years old when he died, Salome that is, he headed Mr. Arafat's Fatah Security and Intelligence Unit with up to 3,700 members and a monthly budget of $1.5 million. The unit was known as Squad 17, apparently because Mr. Salome's office was Extension 17 on the PLO military telephone network. We're going to be coming back to Squad 17 near the end of the broadcast. It's something which is very much with us these days. And the last section of this Wall Street Journal article from 2/10/83 that I'm going to read you is the following. Born April 1st, 1941, Mr. Salome was the son of a well-known Palestinian militant named Sheikh Hassan Salome. Sheikh Hassan was a leader of the Palestinian resistance movement headed by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin Husseini. During the 1948 fighting that led to the creation of Israel, Sheikh Hassan was killed by an Israeli bomb. The family eventually fled to Cairo. Now here are the two of the key names for the section we're about to get into. One is Sheikh Hassan Salome, the father of Ali Hassan Salome, the fellow credited with planning the Olympics massacre of 1972, and a man who, as we've seen, by July of 1973, was establishing contacts with the U.S. and providing security information to the CIA within less than a year of having accomplished the Olympics massacre. Now, it should be noted that Ali Hassan Salome was not a full-time CIA agent. He was simply working for them. He was not a formal agent. However, it's an intriguing relationship. And again, his father, Sheikh Hassan Salome, is a man we're going to be talking about in just a couple of minutes. And in turn, Sheikh Hassan Salome went to work for a man named Haj Amin al-Husseini. And Haj Amin al-Husseini is a person whose background dovetails very nicely with some of the people we were looking at under the Skorzeny mission to Egypt.
Yes. In fact, his background was the same as some of the people, at least in terms of his involvement with the SS. And we're going to talk about that. The segment we're going to read next is from a book entitled The Patriotic Traitors, The History of Collaboration in German-Occupied Europe, 1940-45, by David Littlejohn, published by Doubleday and Company, 1972. This section is headlined, A Man of God and Friend of Hitler. The spiritual welfare of Soviet citizens of the Muslim faith was in good hands. It was the charge of no less a personage than His Eminence, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini. There can be no doubt that he took his responsibilities seriously. An indefatigable worker in the cause of Allah and Adolf Hitler, he toured prisoner of war camps exhorting the faithful to take up arms on behalf of the new order. He reviewed Muslim SS units, their field gray uniforms topped with a fez. He blessed weapons, consecrated standards. He won over a distinguished Tartar poet, Musa Jalil, who agreed to serve on an Idel Ural Tartar committee, which had as its object the establishment of a Muslim state on the banks of the Volga. Idel is the Tartar word for Volga. Nothing ever came of this scheme. Jalil later had second thoughts and tried to back out. For his pains, he was court-martialed and shot by the Germans. The Grand Mufti himself, however, readers will be relieved to learn, came safely through the war. And in fact, as you're going to see in some of the next segments of the broadcast, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, did more in the war than merely review prisoner of war camps. And what they're talking about, the spiritual well-being of Soviet prisoners, they're talking about the large group that we talked about on a past Radio Free Americas of the Sovietized Turks, the people who were, I suppose you'd call them racial or ethnic Turkish peoples or Turkic peoples who fall within the boundaries of the Soviet Union, many of whom are not happy about that state of affairs. And these peoples were heavily recruited by the Nazis during World War II as they moved into the Soviet Union. And the ones who had been captured during a battle with the Soviet Union were actively urged and in many cases convinced to turn against the Soviet Union and to join the Nazis. And as a matter of fact, as we talked on earlier Radio Free Americas, the Gray Wolves, who are the source for people like Mehmet Ali Agha, the would-be assassin of Pope John Paul II, the Gray Wolves were founded largely through cooperation between the Nazis with these pan-Turkist elements. But anyway, we're talking here about Haj Amin al-Husseini, who not only combed the prisoner of war camps for potential new Reich citizens to go and fight the Soviet Union, Muslims, but of course also was involved in some other rather interesting things, not least of which was his friendship with Hasan Salameh.
And in fact, it was even more than just a friendship. Hasan Salameh was one of the most loyal lieutenants of Haj Amin al-Husseini, both while he was working for the Third Reich, and again, as Nip indicated, Haj Amin al-Husseini was working with the so-called outside Turks that we reviewed in Radio Free America number 14 about the World Anti-Communist League. We also went into it at considerable length in Radio Free America number 21, the last of our shows about the Pope shooting, if people would like to read up more about that.